Coming up on this week's show, the cutest version of Street Fighter 2 we've ever seen.
Some big Time Splitters Rewind news.
And we talk Thief, System Shock 2 and Bioshock with Ken Levine.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books, who've actually, can we have a bit of a round of applause, just celebrated their 10th birthday. Come on, guys. Woo. Happy birthday to Sam and the team at Bitmap Books, who've published an incredible 29 books as well. And to celebrate their birthday this month, why don't you have a look at their website, bitmapbooks.com, including their incredible new N64 A visual compendium filled with over 150 titles that defined the N64. Check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 423. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you hanging out with us on the podcast every single Friday. Takes you back to the golden age of video games. Brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And of course, brings you a very special guest on the second half of the podcast. More on that coming up soon. But can we just say a very warm welcome back to Joe Fox?
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. I had a couple of weeks off, didn't I?
I was wondering if you'd listened to the episode with Gareth that we did last week.
What did
you think of his job?
I did. I couldn't think of anybody better. Gareth was actually our first ever Patreon supporter.
Wow.
So I went away with the family for a couple of weeks. So the guys very kindly recorded a week ahead with me, and then I had to miss a week, and we asked Gareth to step in, and I think he did a wonderful job. Put a big smile on my face. I actually listened to the episode this morning on my walk up to the dentist, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I was a little bit worried, actually, because I was like, some of these people we've had on, probably a little bit better than me.
Yeah,
we were thinking
your
that,
job's
yeah.
under threat now.
Yeah, we thought we might not invite you back. You know, Gareth was up for it.
Yeah, so that's it. I'm never going on holiday again. Thank you so much, Gareth, for stepping in. I really, really appreciate it. And thanks for just carrying on with the show, guys.
Yeah.
The show must go on every week.
Yeah, well, we look forward to getting our presents that you've no doubt bought back from your travels for us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, we'll get those after the show, I'm sure. But, of course, lots of retro gaming news stories to bring you up to speed on. We'll chat about that in just a moment and an amazing guest. And now that we are into April, that does mean, you know, clocks have gone forward here in the UK. We are officially into British summertime. I say, looking at the rain pouring outside my window right now. But that means we're getting close to summer events. And of course, the big one that we're excited about is Ravi's second ever massive Amiga show, Kickstart 2, that is coming up. What's the dates again? End of June?
Yeah, so it's on June the 29th and the 30th at Meadow Lane Stadium in Nottingham. And this is the biggest dedicated Amiga show in the world this year. So it's going to be pretty mad. I've gone all out on it. There's a few of the details. We've got announcements on the website, which is amigashow.com, and you can get tickets there. But we've got 18 Amiga traders, so a huge Amiga trader hall. And we've got 10 different groups in the community space. So community space is like a really cool space where you can jam, you can see machines, you can chat to people. That's also where the bar is. So you know, there's a lot of activity going on in the community space. And then we've got five special guests as well coming, which, John Shawler's coming over from America hosting the event. Yeah, we've got Pete Cannon. He's going to be there. Tony Warriner as well, who's, Beneath a Steel Sky, Revolution Software. Stu Cambridge from Sensible Software. We've also got Trevor Dickinson there from Aeon. And, there's a lot of machines that are kind of being announced. I think I counted 3 or 4 new forms of Amiga are going to be announced at the show that we've been talking about. So it's going to be a news generating one, this is. And then we've got a music act as well. And that's a whole video game music night, basically, which contains 5 acts. And that's going to go on till the late hours. But, David Wise of Rare, who did, of course, the soundtrack of Donkey Kong Country, is going to be headlining that. Pete Cannon as well. You know, absolutely amazing producer and DJ, currently on Cool FM. He's going to be dropping some insane Amiga beats, and Hoffman as well, and Vogue Renegade. So we've got a proper mad selection. Like, I wish I could come as a patron rather than organising it.
Can I come? Ravi, you put it on.
Yeah. I've been waiting for someone to do like an Amiga show in the UK, because it's like been almost a decade, hasn't it, since the last one. So yeah, we're to kind of leave it to Ravi today. I wasn't going to do it myself.
Yeah, that's why I did it. Like, last year was kind of a proof of concept thing, and this year I'm going all out. And it's mainly because when I was a kid, I used to go to these shows and they were the best thing ever. And they were completely mad, huge, on a crazy scale, full of Amiga delusion. And that's what this whole thing's about.
So if you want to come along, just over 2 months to go until Kickstart 02. I know a lot of our patrons are traveling over as well for you from different parts of Europe too, so it's going to be nice.
Oh, we've got people coming from Australia. We've got people coming from all over the world, yeah. It's going to be crazy. America as well.
So we'll have a nice little retro hour meetup like we did last year. It was a lot of fun. So if you are coming along to our Kickstart, amigashow.com is a website to get your tickets. Money left? Is it nearly?
Yeah, we've sold about half, and but we've basically increased capacity. So we've doubled our capacity. So we've sold about as much as last year. So if you were there last year, it was quite busy. But we've got extra spaces this year, so it's going to be even more ramo. And we've got a complete new venue, which is a Saltbox Bar in Nottingham, for the after party as well. So that's going to be on a much bigger scale than it was before.
Bring it on. So hopefully we'll see you there end of June. I'll link up the website in this week's show notes if you want to get your tickets for that first big event of the summer. Right, then, we have got an amazing guest this week as well. We're going to be talking about BioShock. Do you remember when you first played BioShock? Yeah, I know you were a big fan of it back in the day, Ravi.
Oh, mind was blown. Like, to me, FPSs, I do mention this in the interview, you know, some of them were kind of just like military realistic simulators. And then going into like a fantasy world with Art Deco underwater, you know, with such characters and kind of entering this world that came alive, that had just been, you know, kind of running on its own underwater. Oh, it's just fantastic. The whole style of it, the whole gameplay, is a masterpiece of a game.
Yeah, I remember that was one of the early games I played on my Xbox 360. I hadn't had it long, I don't think, when I got hold of that, because I think I got my 360 in 2007, so it must have been a very similar time. But I remember, yeah, the opening sequence, you know, when you like first go into the world of Rapture, and then when you find out the game mechanics, like, you know, being genetically modified, and when you see Big Daddy for the first time, which I won't spoil for people that might not have played the game. But yeah, I mean, an absolute legend of an FPS game. And today we're going to be talking to the main man behind it. Ken Levine's going to be joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, and Ken's got such a great career. You know, we are the Retro Hour, so, you know, he's got some modern stuff, but we don't totally focus on BioShock. We go back all the way to his roots, and there's some absolutely interesting discussions in this one. You know, Thief was a game that he worked on that was really interesting. Also, System Shock as well. And Thief was one of the first ones to use the Dark Engine. System Shock was a follow-up that Ken did, System Shock 2. And there's a kind of theme throughout all of his games of atmosphere, of immersion. And we explore the whole idea of where that came from and how it's influenced his game so much.
Yeah, because I mean, he was a bit, you know, obsessed, I'd say, with like Civilization.
Yes, yes, yes. And also Ultima Underworld.
So there are big influences on the direction that he went into in game development as well. Even talking about his early experiences, because he's really into electromechanical games.
Yes, yeah. Which, you know, when we ask people about their first gaming experience, we don't usually get that. We get, you know, it's usually the arcade straight away. But yeah, Ken absolutely loved them. And the whole kind of electromechanical thing kind of works well with BioShock as well, doesn't it? But also we talk about his new projects as well, Judas, which is his latest title coming out. And we also talk about BioShock Infinite as well.
Yeah, so a really interesting guest. If you love those games and that you want to hear more about, like you said, I think, you know, anyone that loves BioShock, I think they're going to be interested in his new game.
Yeah, totally.
A spiritual successor to Bioshock, really, doesn't it? So we'll hear all about that with this week's special guest, Ken Levine. He's coming up on the podcast in around half an hour from now. But of course, you know the way the show works. First 30 minutes or so, that is when we basically have a bit of a geek out, isn't it? A bit of a natter about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and tech over the last 7 days. And lots for you to catch up on, Joe. Have you been keeping an eye on this stuff while you've been lazing around the pool?
I have a little bit. Been keeping an eye. I'm in all the groups and stuff on now on Facebook, always seeing what's coming out and stuff like that. And plus I had to look back and see what news you guys spoke about last week, so I didn't double anything up. But yeah, this one definitely caught my eye, and I'm sure it caught your eye as well, Ravi. Time Splitters Rewind has re-emerged this last kind of week, which I imagine is following the closure of Free Radical Designs in December, I think it was, or November. For those of you who don't know, Time Splitters Rewind was essentially a remake of the original Time Splitters games, you know, a HD remake, which was actually a fan-made project, which has been in the works since 2013. They've been working on this. And it's essentially, it's a group of developers who have just been making it themselves in their spare time. And, you know, it picked up some traction online. And a few years ago, there was even a petition to make it an official release, you know, for a publisher to pick it up. And it had like 50,000 signatures, you know, 50,000 backers. But it just never came to fruition. And as you know, as many listeners are probably aware, it's because Time Splitters has been kind of in development hell for the last, what, like 15 years? I'm assuming when they actually announced there was going to be an official fourth Time Splitters game, they probably took a step back and said, well, Time Splitters Rewind is going to have to stop because we're probably going to get a cease and desist on this.
It's interesting. I've looked into that. So it's like, you know, we know Free Radical. They've been trying to create a new Time Splitters for a long time, and the studio disappeared recently.
Yeah,
which was really sad to see. And you know, we've seen some footage come out of the new Time Splitters games. Well, this one's, as I said, it's been going on for absolute years, and it's mainly because it's a fan project.
Yeah,
and they're kind of doing it for a free game. You know, it's not going to be a game that they're making any money on. So it's all people's spare time that they're doing this with, and seeing what they've created has been absolutely amazing. Now, Crytek were the original owners of the brand after Free Radical.
Yeah.
And they gave permission to develop a Time Splitters mod using the CryEngine, like an official mod to these guys years ago. And they basically said Time Splitters 4 was the ultimate goal of the Time Splitters Rewind team. So they wanted to kind of get to that kind of, you know, feel and era, but also have all the elements of the older Time Splitters within there. They had something where they were stuck with the CryEngine because that was the agreement that Crytek had kind of said. And then they've managed to move on to the Unreal Engine. But I think they've said at one point, from what I've found, is that they may have to do a rebrand if that hits it, but it's kind of worth being on that engine, you know, because it's such a powerful one compared to the CryEngine now. Because, you know, technology's moved on over that time period that they've done it. But what they're actually asking for is, you know, they put out in 2022 that the game is looking and feeling really close.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is final kind of wrap-ups and clean-ups that they need. But because they're a small team, it's all being done on love and passion.
Yeah.
They need some people to come in and help add that final kind of polish because they see that there's that Time Splitters kind of power vacuum at the moment, and they want to move into that space to please the fans and, you know, actually get it out as well, because I'm sure being in development for that long is quite a frustrating thing.
Yeah, yeah. 11 years they've been at this. And like you say, that is just passion and love. And they've been doing it all for free, you know, kind of like out of their own pocket. So like you say, they've done a video essentially, you know, kind of like a, you know, an army, we need you to join the force kind of thing. And they're looking for people to wipe out bugs, kind of like technical designers, developers, anybody who's willing to help with the project, who's, you know, kind of got industry knowledge. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see if anybody who was actually working at the new Free Radical studio.
What, suddenly they get the whole Free Radical team just going and joining? That would be amazing.
That's an interesting point, though, because, and I know, because watching this update, which from what I've seen is actually the first kind of news we've heard about this in about a year, everyone kind of assumed that this was dead. But then Jake Parr, who is the lead writer on this, he's put up this new video. But he doesn't mention, I mean, I haven't seen a breakdown of who the team are, but from what I've seen of this update, they're people that were working in the games industry full time and doing this like on an evening and weekends. But the problem is that now, the way the games industry is going, they basically can't afford the time to work on this for free.
You need a team of like 200, don't you?
Yeah.
With huge developments like that, you know, it's hard to do as a fan project. So good on them, though, for, you know, putting the word out and getting it in the news like this again.
And looking at the video as well, I mean, I hadn't seen a few of the kind of more recent updates, but I've got to say, I mean, you mentioned there, Ravi, that it kind of does feel like it's pretty close. Looking at that gameplay footage, I mean, you know, the worlds that they've made and that the graphics are jaw-dropping.
Yeah, it's time splitters, isn't it? It just looks awesome. And the thing is, we've seen footage of all of these kind of like the new time splitters, and that looks amazing. I just want to play one of them, you know? I think that's the frustration of everybody.
Yeah, and it would be such a shame if this didn't make it out after 13 years of, you know, people waiting for it. And
Man, just imagine getting hammered at the end of there with like a change. That would just be awful, or a take there. Mate,
playing this is like a Christmas get together or something. Like I'm watching it now and it looks fantastic. And I think it is such a shame that the official one got closed down, because of, I just feel like the industry, you know, the kind of the stratosphere of FPSs is crying out for like these fun party shoot 'em ups. Cause obviously it's just been Call of Duty and Battlefield and stuff for so long now. I mean, I know there's been other games and there's been attempts at doing these like fun games, but I just don't think any of them have picked up the traction that TimeSplitters ever did.
And it does worry me a bit that it's kind of based on an agreement with Crytek, who no longer exist.
Mm.
And now Free Radical's been sold on. And it's like based on a loose agreement, you know, years ago. Legal status, it's like, I think they want to get it finished and out there, you know, because I'd hate to see this get taken down.
I guess worst case scenario, they could always rebrand it as, you know, something else, not Time Splitters, and change their characters up a bit, you know.
Time Cutters.
Yeah, that one. There you go. Have that one on us. So if you do want to get involved in it, if you have got any industry experience, like you said, they're looking for people to test it out as well. Anyone that's got experience illustrating, animators, anyone that wants to get into the gaming industry, you know, they're saying this would look, you know, how amazing would this look on your CV if you're trying to get into the gaming industry right now. So if you do want to get involved in this, they have got a Discord server where you can get hold of the team if you'd like to join them as well and get a look at the development so far. We would love to see this happen. So if you've got any interest in playing Time Splitters Rewind and helping them get it finished, I'll link that up in the show notes as well, crossing everything that happens. Now, we have been giving quite a lot of love to the Commodore Plus 4 on the podcast recently, you know, which was my first computer. Does feel like, you know, the homebrew scene on that has been really active recently. But a couple of years ago, it seemed like the Amstrad was getting all the love. And it turns out, actually, there have been a few interesting developments in the world of Amstrad again recently. We mentioned that Lord Sugar has bought back the brand, going to be turning it into a digital marketing company. So wasn't all that exciting when we actually drilled down into that. But there have been some great new homebrew developments on the Amstrad scene recently, including this, possibly the cutest version of Street Fighter we've ever seen.
I really love the look of this. So this is another fan-made project coming to the Amstrad. And it is a version of Street Fighter 2, which will be called Mighty Street Fighter. And for those of you who don't know, there is a version of Final Fight, which is obviously also a Capcom game as well as Street Fighter, and is set in the same universe as Street Fighter, and was originally going to be a sequel to the original Street Fighter, but then they made it its own kind of game and franchise. That Final Fight has a version of it called Mighty Final Fight for the NES, and that was kind of like a stripped down version of Final Fight where you played as little chibi anime kind of versions of the characters. And that's famously become a very rare, expensive game in America. And I'm not sure if it ever came out in the UK. Anyway, you know, there was Pocket Fighters, you know, in the 90s and stuff, and kind of these like little kid versions of Street Fighter, you know, which was done on like the Sega Saturn and the PlayStation 1. But we never really saw the original kind of Street Fighter 2 in this version. And I think this looks fantastic. So Mighty Street Fighter, which is coming to the Amstrad, is essentially a homage to that, you know, Mighty Final Fight, where all the characters are these little chibi versions.
Seeing little Blanka as a chibi, he looks so cute, doesn't he?
They look so cute. And I think, you know, that kind of takes away the theme of it, and the look of this game is actually taking away, because so far it is just a video of a demo. And, you know, there's 8 characters on there. You've got Ryu, Ken, E-Honda, Chun-Li, Zangief, Blanka, Guile, and Dalsim. So the original Street Fighter 2 lineup that was playable, as well as the bosses in there, as well as 10 different levels to play on. And I think graphically, this looks fantastic, because I'm sat here talking about like, oh yeah, it's the chibi version, it looks great, it's a homage to Final Fight, kind of forgetting what this is actually running on. And it looks great. Yeah. It looks absolutely fantastic. It's running really well.
And they've got a lot of the moves, and also, to be honest, like this runs better than like Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo on the Amiga, which is a really bad port. But it looks playable, you know, and it's on the CPC and also the GX 4000 as well. But I really enjoyed the music on this as well. It's absolutely banging.
Yeah, no, the music is really, really fantastic. I mean, like I say, there's no details on when this is going to be available for people to play just yet, but just musically, everything about it, like this to me looks like a full kind of like NES release or like a Switch release or something that you would get. I mean, for me, it was just the fact of how quickly it was running and that, you know, a lot of the moves are present, and it is, although it is the chibi cutesy version, it is so clearly Street Fighter 2. And I think the pixel art in it, you know, the people who are behind this hasn't been rushed. This is like really, really fantastic looking.
Yeah, some beautiful gradient graphics for the sky as well. There's going to be tutorial training mode, 3 difficulty modes as well. The special moves of combos are going to be in there. 10 backgrounds based on areas from Street Fighter 2, like the Battle Harbor, the Air Force Base, Big Factory as well. So, I mean, this does look like it's going to be a really full and complete game. And I think I'm just kicking myself that I didn't pick up a GX 4000 like 10 years ago when they were very cheap.
Yeah, they were dirt cheap, weren't they, Dan? I remember we used to go to places and see them for like 40 quid sealed and stuff. It was crazy.
Yeah, there was a game shop near here in Lincoln, Gotham Games it was called. It's closed down now, sadly. And I remember seeing a box one in there for probably was about that price, 50 quid. And I remember eyeing it up. I don't know if you've ever had this when you're in a shop and like you literally are about to reach for it. But then like last minute you think, oh, am I going to play it? That kind of little, you know, devil on my shoulders. Like,
I think that's every retro show that I go to. I'm like reaching for stuff like, oh, do I need an Atari Lynx?
Yeah, so that is one of my retro regrets that I didn't pick it up, because I think then and a lot of us didn't really realise this kind of untapped power of the Amstrad CPC computers. You know, when I saw that Pinball Fantasies remake on there, like, 6-7 years ago, that's kind of when I realized it's a bit more powerful than I assumed it was. Because back in the day, the Amstrad CPC, it seemed like most of it was basically straight Spectrum ports, wasn't it? That really didn't tap into the power of the system. So, this is, if you've got an Amstrad CPC 128K or a GX 4000 gathering dust, this could be a good excuse to dig it out. We'll keep an eye on that. And if you want to check out the video so far, I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, talking about videos, this one made me laugh. It is one of our favourite YouTubers. This is James Channel, who you might remember. He was the YouTuber who made that Nintendo PlayStation console by hand a few months ago.
Yeah. I love his videos because they're so kind of like, they're thrilling. You know, it's a bit of a roller coaster because he's just there with like saws and, you know, circular saws and buzz saws, just cutting up PlayStations and Nintendos like bare hand. And you just think he's going to cut his thumb off like any moment, because he's like, he's talking to the camera while he's doing it. And he's just like snapping bits of plastic by hand, and you're just like, oh, but then it's always so amazing and like fantastic at the end, and it's very watchable. Like, you can't keep take your eyes off it, you know, you're kind of like squirming.
There's some YouTube channels where it's all clean and people 3D print stuff and they do it all very nicely. I like those, but I also kind of like the blokes that just bang things together.
Yeah.
And this channel is very like that, but also that's like how I did a lot of modifications on my stuff when I was a kid. I've probably some stuff that I absolutely cringe at nowadays.
He basically, like you said, he snaps things apart by hand. This new video is him basically turning, they're calling this the NES Inception video. He turns a NES cartridge into a console. But watching this all the way through, most of this video is done using a circular saw. That there are parts of this video where he slips a few times and gets very close to his thumb.
It's an angle grinder, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is not a thing that you normally would hold, you know, 2 centimetres from your thumb without any protection at all. James doesn't mind, though. A lot of hot glue and a heat gun that he burns himself with several times in the video as well. But the end result is probably better than something that I could do if I spent months doing it carefully, because it works.
Oh, yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah, so he's basically got a NES cart and one of these AliExpress kind of consoles, you know, one of these
clone consoles. Yeah,
clone consoles. And then he's ripped the internals out of the cartridge and put the clone console inside. But it's not a case of just placing it in there. He's expanded the boards out, you know, connected them up. It's quite interesting. Have you played with any of these clone consoles?
I've never played one. Like, I've been tempted to buy them in the past, you know, just kind of like for space saving and thinking, oh, do I sell my collection, etc. And I know they can be really hit or miss. Like, sometimes you can get an absolute bargain and they work fantastic, and then other times, you know, they literally, you know, don't even have a stereo input on them and like are absolute junk. So I'm not too sure if it's like a junk one that he's bought, but yeah.
Well, he's not using expensive stuff. That's what I like about it. You know, he's not using a rare prototype or, you know, a, like a...
I've got an original prototype Famicom. Yeah.
His last one was just kind of you know, cutting old case that wasn't being used. And, and this is an old cartridge. So I kind of enjoy that he can just rip it to bits and just, you know, go mad with it because, yeah, monetary-wise, it's not worth that much.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth watching the video. So basically, he trims down this circuit box. It turns out, you know, both this clone console that he's bought and the original NES cartridges, there's actually quite a lot of room inside them. You know, the circuit boards are very small. Mm-hmm. So it turns out he's actually got room in there to keep the original game in the cartridge, but also put this clone console in the top part of it as well. And he, you know, sloppily cuts out some holes for controller ports and video output and even stuff like, you know, he uses USB for the power, which he kind of embeds, again, quite sloppily in the top of it, and then hooks it up, gets it working. He does make quite a few mistakes because of the way that he's done it. He's cut a lot of traces and things don't work as you'd expect, but he gets them all working. And then I think the best bit of the video is at the end, he actually takes this, basically this Frankenstein's monster of an NES console inside a cartridge, plugs it back in to an original NES, and the game is still playable as well. So that is why
that's insane.
NES Inception, they call it.
So. And the final part is fixing the console with BlueTac, which, you know, it's a great technical one. And I like that it's not like a Nintendo World Championship cart, but
it's Mario
kind
Golf.
Of funny if he'd sprayed it gold, you know, just to wind people up, yeah.
As much as I love like Adrian's digital basement and, you know, YouTubers like that, I think there is something, you know, I love this kind of mad scientist approach that he's got in this channel. So if you want to check it out, I will link that. James Channel is his name. This is making a NES cartridge into a full console. I'll link that up and, of course, the rest of the stories in this week's show notes. Now, we have got some more to talk about, including a quite rare 3DO FPS game that is getting a remaster and a brand new Mega Drive game that I'm sure will have Joe's appetite nicely whetted in just a moment. Before we do that, though, just a little reminder that The big reason that we can do this podcast each week is thanks to the wonderful community that we have around the show, and that is our incredible patrons. And we have got some rather exciting news, as I can probably start replying to the several hundred messages that I've had over the last 12 months going, I missed your Kickstarter, can I buy a book?
Yeah, we've had quite a lot of them in the last couple of months, haven't we? But yeah, we are finally able to put our overstock up for sale, and we're going to be putting it out to the patrons to begin with, aren't we? For anybody who backs us on Patreon who missed it at the time.
I mean, we do have new listeners coming in all the time. Kind of set up what this was then, Joe, for people that maybe weren't listening a year ago.
So about 2 years ago, we had the crazy idea to make the podcast into a tangible physical form. And we actually picked 10 of our favorite interviews that we've ever done, and 10 interviews that we think are maybe some of our most influential videos, well, influential from the guests that we interviewed, and put it into a book, which we crowdfunded in December 2022. And then we did an additional 4 interviews in there, exclusive interviews, which have never been on the show. And we put it into a book, which was over 400 pages long, which was in people's hands in the over the last couple of months. And we're really, really, really proud of it. And yeah, we've got about 100 left over, haven't we? To kind of send out to people if they want to get their hands on it.
Yeah, well, the good news is now that I think, you know, pretty much everyone that backed it on Kickstarter appears to have their copy now. So that doesn't mean we have got, you know, some left, because we did get a few more printed. And we've had a load of people asking, how do I get hold of one? So what we're going to do is, right now, if you join us on Patreon or you're already a member on Patreon, you'll have access to this as well. I'm going to put 50 up there just to start with this weekend. So if you'd like to get it, and we are actually going to sell these at the same price that they were on Kickstarter, to our patrons as well. So if you want to get a hold of it, if you did miss out on that Kickstarter that we did, like you said, in December of 2022, and you've wanted to get hold of a Retro Hour book, maybe you've just started listening since then, a lot of people have been asking. So get on there this weekend. You can support us on Patreon. Of course, it helps out the podcast as well. And get early access to the Retro Hour book if you would like a copy on your shelf as well.
Also, on April the 7th, Sunday, we're having our patrons hangout as well. So don't forget that if you're a patron.
Yeah, this coming Sunday, we didn't move it because Joe was away last weekend, and everyone had plans with it being the Easter break. So we're going to be doing our March hangout in April on this coming Sunday from 8 p.m. UK time. If you haven't joined us for a hangout before, it's basically we all get together on a massive Zoom call and just geek out for a couple of hours about everything retro, shout pickups, get advice, bit of a virtual users group, really. So a very good time to join us on Patreon right now. Support the podcast, get hold of a book, and join us for this weekend's hangout. All the details to join us on there are on the website at theretrohour.com. Now, you've always got your eye on new games for the Mega Drive, Joe. And this one looks pretty impressive so far.
Yeah, so this is going to be Cyber Mission, which is being developed by PSCD Games, who have actually made quite a few Mega Drive games recently, including Black Jewel Reborn and Hunter Girls, which were both actually crowdfunded campaigns, but they unfortunately got cancelled, and they decided just to sell the games directly from their website and, you know, kind of like, you know, make them as they're paid for, which I believe is what they're going to be doing with Cyber Mission as well. Now, this is interesting because of, obviously, a lot of these kind of modern retro games that come out and, you know, are released on, you know, Mega Drive, etc. They're usually kind of like based on quite popular games. This is very akin to Forgotten Worlds. Are you guys familiar with that game?
Yeah, I've got that on the Amiga.
Yeah, I've played it. I've got it. But never see it as like, oh, that's a classic retro game.
It's not one that I normally go to on my list of games when I boot up my Xbox 100
for a month. Yeah, you don't tend to see it in the top 10 Mega Drive or Amiga games or anything like that. I always thought it was a Contra ripoff, but it's not. It's actually more of a shoot 'em up. You play as it's a two-player co-op game, and you kind of play as like on a jetpack, aren't you? And you know you kind of fly across the moving screen, and you can shoot forwards and backwards, kind of bullet hell. And this Cyber Mission is incredibly similar to that, but obviously graphically, with the amount of enemies on the screen and stuff like that, using kind of modern techniques, the game is looking super smooth, super detailed, you know, kind of parallax scrolling in the background, lots and lots of enemies on the screen.
Very nice pixel art.
Yeah, or as always, you know, with these kind of modern Mega Drive games, but it does, it feels at the moment, you know, and I could be wrong, but we're talking about like a new Mega Drive game, Sega Genesis game, like every week at the moment. Like it is actually crazy how many.
We could probably do two or three an episode.
Yeah, two or three a week, you know, like it's just crazy how many are actually coming out. And like, I feel sorry for completionists, you know, who include these releases in like, you know, the lineup of like wanting to like get every single game.
Do they count them though? Because I know your friend Jason is a Mega Drive completionist. Does he count like the new releases and homebrew stuff?
He doesn't because right. of, I think more just from like a cost point of view, because what you find is often these games will come out, you know, for £40, $40, £50 kind of thing. And they quickly, especially if they're popular, become incredibly expensive, such as Paprium, you know, which is on the older side now. Yeah.
And that's on like a special cart as well.
Yeah, that can command like £300 now on eBay. Like, you know, I see people trying to sell the special edition of that for hundreds of hundreds. So I think just from a cost point of view, some collectors just kind of, you know, they'll buy it if they want it, if it looks good kind of thing. You know, back it when it's, you know, when it first comes out kind of thing. Personally, I don't see it as like this is part of the original lineup, but I think for me, it's once again, it comes to that where do you stop kind of and cost factor. Not that I'm trying to get a full Mega Drive collection, because I just think the amount of money that it costs now is just insane. But it's good to see fans of Sega still making Sega games in 2024. You know, the Sega died, what, in 95, 96, the Mega Drive. So we're coming up to 30 years ago.
It never died, Joe.
It never died. It still lives on, but it's just amazing to see the capabilities of, you know, what people are pushing the console to do on original hardware now. And then I know there's games like Paprium, as you say, Ravi, that have got special carts and stuff like that, you know, that can do so much more. But so many of these games that are coming out don't have those special carts and are just original. This is original hardware and original cart. And look how amazing it looks. And yeah, you know, Cyber Mission is going to be another one of those games.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether it's going to physical release or not. I mean, it might just be a ROM download, but it looks like it's only a alpha version at the moment.
It looks like it's going to get a physical release because of PSCD games do the physical releases of these games. You know, you just buy them directly from them for $45 with cartridge and cartridge and case. They usually do them with. So I believe this will get a physical release as well.
It looks like they are doing a Kickstarter for this one.
Okay, that's brilliant. That's
so
good
there you
to
go.
It
looks like that should be a full release and fingers crossed. So yeah, it looks like they're setting that up at the moment. So if you want to keep an eye on that, I will link up their website and the video as well, so you can check those out. Now, Night Dive Studios have obviously done some very high-profile remasters and updates of classic games for modern consoles in recent years. We've got the Quake 1 and 2 special editions. Now, love those on the Switch. Turok, we're talking about Turok 3 they did recently. Star Wars Dark Forces as well. Must admit, this latest title from them is a little bit left of centre. Have you heard of Poed before?
I've heard of it, never played it. Never really watched gameplay of it until now. Am I right in thinking it was a 3DO game in the mid-90s?
Yeah, well, this was a FPS game that came out in 1995.
Right.
Developed by a company called Any Channel Inc. For the 3DO Interactive Multiplayer. The idea is that you are a chef who is attempting to escape a hostile alien world. Then a year later, they did a version for the PlayStation 1. But now it turns out, I mean, I must admit, if I'm thinking of 3DO FPS games, Killing Time's generally the one that most people think of.
I think, you know, these early FPS struggled a lot. So here's a review from Maximum back in the days about Poed, saying it's the worst 3D action title ever seen on any format. With the
Remaster
exception
it.
Of Crime Crackers on the PlayStation or early PC public domain games. Indeed, the graphics and gameplay are very reminiscent of past atrocities.
To be fair, I could show them a few Amiga FPS games that might change their mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, it looks like an interesting, fun title, but it may not have run as well back then. But, you know, jazzing it up for the modern age has probably, you know, turned it into an actual playable game. I found that a lot with, some of the FPSs on the Amiga. When I use an accelerator, I can actually play them and think, oh, this is quite decent, and put it into a better kind of, speed and make it more playable. Whereas before, it was a glitchy mess, as they say. But, some other people thought it was all right. There was some 79% ratings in 3DO magazines and stuff.
Well, I mean, 95, that was, right in the heart of kind of the FPS craze, wasn't it? Between Doom and Quake, I suppose, around that time. And the 3DO was, again, another almost ran system. They came out at a very weird era between the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive and, the PlayStation. So it was a strange time in the industry, I think. But the concept of the game I do like. The fact that you play this kind of crazy chef and your weapons include a frying pan to smack aliens over the head with. And a jetpack as well.
You know what it stands for?
What, Poed?
Yeah. Pissed off.
Right.
Nice.
So it might be peed off then, I guess. Pierre, I don't know. Yeah. I've always pronounced it Poed. But yeah, it's. I think, it is a very unusual title to do an update of. And again, I think probably most people have forgotten. But you're right, Night Dive Studio are going to be doing a full updated version of Poed called the Definitive Edition, coming to PC and consoles, including updated visuals, increased frame rate, up to 4K graphics as well, fixing up the controls, which is often one thing if you go back and you try and play these early FPS games on original hardware. That's the one thing that generally throws me off quite a bit. So I was playing some FPS games on the N64. Perfect Dark I was playing on that, actually. And that, just feels weird playing it with just one analog stick on.
Those early FPSs that I really enjoy, like the kind of short rooms with tall, high ceilings and, spaces like that, but also, kind of garish textures.
The textures remind me of Quake quite a bit, actually, the first Quake.
Yeah, it does. It does look like Quake, but obviously in the 4K version, it's all been cleaned up a bit and stuff. And it looks interesting. It looks absolutely mental as well. Like, to me, nothing in this kind of balances. But that can make it fun, and it feels very nostalgic at the time. It does kind of look a bit PD as well to me, public domain. But yeah, I love that stuff, so I can see how nostalgically this is a really cool one for them to release. And I'm surprised that they've kind of gone for this. It must be a kind of a huge decision. Let's take this one back. Or maybe there was a Poed fan, on the team.
I just, I want them to do Blood. Did you guys ever play that? The mid-90s FPS? Yeah.
Blood's a classic, yeah.
I don't think that's ever come to console. And I just think
Redneck Rampage, that's what.
Yeah, I think Night Dive need to do them. Like, this is cool. I'm sure there's probably a lot of fans for, Poed.
Probably not.
Maybe. But yeah, it just does seem like a strange one. They've done so many popular games before. Maybe it was just they could get the IP. Who knows? But they've definitely, from the trailer, they've definitely cleaned it up and modernized it. So maybe it is a lot more playable now.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if they think this is worth restoring, it's making me more interested in it. Like I said, I'm familiar with it on the 3DO. I don't think I've ever played it. Maybe I burnt like a CD of it once for the 3DO and played it for like 5 minutes. But the fact that, like I said, they've done such big games like Quake and Turok and stuff like that, the fact that Night Dive are thinking, well, this is worth doing, is making me want to have a second look at this game or a proper look at it. So there you go. If you want to try out maybe an FPS game that you weren't familiar with before, the Definitive Edition is going to be coming to Windows via Steam and GOG, PlayStation 4 and 5, Xbox and Nintendo Switch, apparently in the very near future. So if you want to check that out and the trailer so far, I'll link that up. And of course, the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. I put them in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can head to our website and click through from theretrohour.com. Right, patrons, stay tuned. We have got a couple of extra news stories just for our wonderful patrons, because we do that every week on the podcast. We chop all the adverts out for the patrons, so we give you like an extra 10, 15 minutes of news. That is coming up in a second. Everybody else, get ready for our interview with the amazing Ken Levine talking about BioShock and lots more. Before that, though, let's just take a second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and it is one of our longest-running sponsors, our wonderful mates at ExpressVPN. And the reason we love ExpressVPN is not only, you know, the privacy aspects of VPNs, keeping us secure as well and looking after our data, but we love the fact that you can actually get access to more from your streaming services. Because we've talked about this before, the fact that Netflix, you know, amazingly, they've got more than 18,000 titles available on Netflix worldwide. But if you live in like the US, for example, you only actually get access to 6,000 of those. And you know the prices that services like Netflix, they're increasing all the time. So really it means not only you're not getting value for money, but you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows as well, unless you use ExpressVPN. Now, how does this work, Ravi?
Yeah, well, ExpressVPN, you can install the app, you can have it on your phone, you can have it on your laptop, on your tablet, TV, or even have it on your router. And basically, you just change location straight away whilst you're watching Netflix, refresh it, and then you're able to see the libraries from the location that you've chose throughout the world. And the thing is, it's really good as well because it's really fast. There's no buffering going on there. And that's great because you can access a lot of shows that are not available on other Netflix. So one I've been watching on the US Netflix is I've Got the Hookup, which is a one that I mentioned before, a fantastic film, Master P, kind of a crime comedy rap film about mobile phones being hacked in the 90s, which is just like ultimately cool. Of course, Team America.
Oh, yeah.
Total underrated film. And Rain Man as well, which I've been watching on USA Netflix. And I can't get them in the UK, so it's just great that I can do that.
Yeah, no, ExpressVPN lets you change your online location to more than over 100 different locations around the world. So that means you unlock so much more, thousands of new shows. And not only Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, BBC iPlayer, that normally is UK only. So that's the thing, ExpressVPN pays for itself. And it works on all these different devices, you know, your phone, your laptop, tablet, TV, you name it. It just works on there as well. Really fast, no buffering. And it is a VPN service that we choose. So if you'd like to try out ExpressVPN for yourself, then why don't you use our exclusive link? And of course, you'll be helping out the podcast by supporting our sponsors. And also, we'll give you a nice little discount as well. You'll get 3 months extra free on a one-year plan. So use our exclusive link so they know that we sent you, expressvpn.com/retro. That is expressvpn.com/retro to get 3 months on a one-year plan completely free. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And a massive thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support of the show. Well, thank you for checking out the news this week. A little reminder as well that if you do enjoy the podcast, we appreciate not everybody can support us on Patreon, we get that. But if there is, you know, if you would like to help us out, there's one little thing that you could do. If you can leave us a little nice rating and review on your podcast client of choice. We did get a few nice ones on Apple Podcasts, didn't we, over the last couple of weeks? So we're always keeping an eye on those. And Ravi generally is the first to spot them and screenshot them and send them over. So it is not only very heartwarming to see, you know, it means a lot to us, but also really helps out the podcast as well, because nice reviews on, you know, places like Spotify and Apple Podcasts get us up the algorithms, you know, it's good for that. Gets in the podcast charts, gets us in front of new people as well, so it all helps out. So if you would like to do something to help out the show, that is really appreciated. And next, keep it here, we have got this week's very special guest going inside the world of games like Thief, System Shock 2, and of course, the legendary BioShock with our guest Ken Levine. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And today, someone who's a true visionary in the video games industry, and I worked on some incredible games. I mean, listing off some of these titles: Thief, System Shock 2, BioShock, BioShock Infinite, and the incredible new game as well that we're looking forward to called Judas. I'm sure we'll get into, and lots of history as well with our guest this week, Ken Levine. How's it going, Ken?
Great to see you guys. I'm very looking forward to talking about the old games that helped form me.
Yeah, well, that's our favourite subject, talking about old games. So you're in good company here. Now, one thing that we always like to find out from our guests is kind of a bit of background on where your interest in gaming and computers began. I mean, do you remember your first video game experience, where it all started for you?
Yeah, I mean, my first game experiences were electromechanical machines. I think, you know, we were talking about a minute ago, which is before there were video games, there were these, you know, the most basic version of it is pinball, right? But there was a lot of games, like there were baseball games that used like a silver ball, you know, actually like a pinball and a mechanical bat. And there was like the field was like painted with like baseball players in it. And you know, if you hit the third baseman, sometimes you use even like a metal miniature or something, you know, you would be out. And I'm sure it was just like, it had a sensor if the ball hit it, you know, and the ball would drain. There was things like, you could actually see it. There's like the shark attack game. I can't remember what it's called, but you actually see it in the movie Jaws. They're playing it in the arcade that used basically a bunch of frames, of pre-painted frames, and lights would go on and off behind them. And it would, you had a little like gun you were shooting at it, but, and I'm sure it just had a very simple like IR, you know, hit detection of some kind. But man, when I saw that game the first time, that was like animated 3D art, you know, it was amazing. And then, so there are a lot of early electrum, and then there was games going back to the turn of the century. I used to go to this place at this mall near me in New Jersey, where I grew up, where they had these like turn of the century electromechanical machines that were really interesting and had a great aesthetic. And, you know, they used to run on a penny or a dime or something like that. And then, of course, you know, when the actual video games came in, like Pong, I still remember Pong coming in, and Pac-Man and Space Invaders, you know, it's kind of hard to describe. Mm. As a kid, I think because I didn't really have a lot of friends, and getting like, you know, having games you could play by yourself, you know, because otherwise I'd be like in my basement playing Monopoly by myself. Or if, you know, I got into even these like complicated, my brother turned me on to these complicated like hex-based board games like Squad Leader or something, but I play them against myself.
Right.
So having an opponent, you know, to play against, you know, when you're playing, you know, a direct opponent in multiplayer games, but didn't have a lot of friends, but didn't like, you know, be able to play. You don't need a friend to play Pac-Man. You don't need a friend to play Space Invaders. And having that activity that I can do like uncompromised, you know, because you couldn't do a board game without people, but you could do a video game with people. And that was just, and that solved a lot of my problems as a kid.
That kind of mix between physical and playing a game is really interesting. Like, I think it was Qubit, where they had a pinball knocker in the actual arcade machine as well. And you get some of those modern, you know, pinball machines with like video screens and kind of game stuff. And I think that theme's gone into a few of your games in the future. But I was wondering, what was your first kind of home computer then, when you got one to play games by yourself?
So I got my Atari in the eighth grade, my Atari 2600. And then of all the computers, my mom bought there was a thing called a Coleco Atom, which was like a spruced up ColecoVision. If you guys know that console,
yeah,
it was. I don't know if it came out there, but it came out in the States, and it had a very rudimentary, like it had this like fast tape drive, basically cassette, like a custom cassette drive that was faster than you used to load video games. Like first you were loading, you know, when you got home computers, you used to have to like type in everything. But then they had tape, you know, literal cassette tapes would be the storage device, and then floppy disks. But this was sort of had the storage device that was like a fast access cassette tape, but it was still really slow. And it came with one game called Buck Rogers and the Planet of Zoom or something. But because it was a computer, my mom wouldn't let me play the game on it. So I could only play games on my Atari. And I just had a little black and white television to play my Atari on, because my mom thought it would like break the color TV for some reason.
Right.
I had a pretty limited access to a lot of things. I mean, you know, but I would have my birthday at the arcade, and, you know, and I'm sure you guys remember the arcade used to be where the innovation happened.
Yeah.
You know, there were so many new ideas in the early era because nobody knew what the thing was, right? You know, now when you go to the arcade, it's all basically, it's a few gun games. There's a bunch of basically pinball machines and a bunch of gambling games, effectively. But then it was like, oh my God, what's this? What is this game? And it has like, you know, like Dragon's Lair. It's got like a laser disc, and you've got, you know, even like Qbert, you know, these weird innovations of like having a mechanical knocking device in the thing.
hybrids. Like there was a Pac-Man game. There was a hybrid pinball machine and a Pac-Man game. There was all these real innovation that was happening there, both technologically, because back then the home versions weren't nearly as good as the arcade versions. But now the arcades, the machines running in arcades are not particularly powerful.
Like you're not. It looks like mobile games in arcades. Yeah, now, a lot of the time.
Yes. And they kind of are. It's kind of depressing. Yeah. The arcade is a pretty depressing place now, I think. Yeah. Because it's not, the market just doesn't incentivize, you know, innovation. But so the innovation now is happening, you know, primarily like in the indie space, you know, in computer games mostly right now.
Well, I'm looking at the Coleco Adam and yeah, it looks a really unique machine. Actually, it looks a bit like a music center with the tape unit there in the front. Looks like a hi-fi separate or something.
Like a hi-fi. But yeah, that was it. That was a storage device, like a weird custom storage solution that they had that didn't work very well.
Well, said, you know, today that'd be the equivalent of $2,220 if you were to buy one today. So, you know, the fact that your mother invested in that machine back then, I mean, what were you doing with it then? Did you try your hand at programming at that time? What were you kind of doing on the Adam?
So I did, you know, word processing for my school and I tried to program. Like we actually had these computers called PETs, Commodore PETs in school, and they were basically a green screen, monochrome screen with no real graphics capability. You could do remap character sets, which I'm sure you guys remember those, you could sort of make rudimentary graphics out of different, you know, they replaced the font, the basic font, with some very simple block shapes that you could combine in some really like rudimentary way to make visuals. But we'd go in every day and they used to have books like programming games in BASIC, and it would have like a list of programs, and you literally go in the morning and you type that stuff in, and you, if you're lucky, before homeroom started, you can get the whole game in and play it once. But then they didn't have any tape drives, so you basically turned the computer off and you got to like retype in for like an hour, half an hour, and then you play for like 5 minutes, and then you'd have to do it all again the next day. But people, the friends I had then, I made a lot of friends around computing. You know, that was super exciting at the time. Yeah, those were amazing little devices.
Yeah, you were also a fan of Civilization as well, which I think is a series that's kind of stood the test of time. It's still going today. What drew you to that series then, and why did it stand out?
Civilization, I think I first played it. I remember playing it on a friend's borrowed PC because I didn't have a computer. I had a Macintosh back then, but there were like no games for the Macintosh because I was a graphic designer, so I needed to have a Macintosh. But I wanted a PC, but I couldn't afford it. So a friend loaned me a PC for like a week, and I got Civilization, XCOM, and Ultima Underworld to play on it, I remember.
Right.
And Civilization was just one of those games that you couldn't even imagine it was possible because it was so much more sophisticated than anything like it. And it was pretty complex, like figuring, especially with the rudimentary graphics, like figuring out, you know, the balance between, they still have all the same things, like the balance between, you know, luxury items and you know, the guns and butter decisions. Do I build more weapons? Do I build, and it had all that stuff in the first one. And I played it endlessly. And it was like a full war game and a full, like, you know, building game. And it was incredible. So I think that game really stood out at its time as what strategy games could become. And then XCOM came out shortly after that. MicroProse is just really doing incredible things in the strategy space. And those games, I mean, you can go back and play. I'm sure if somebody could remaster the original Civilization, it would play okay. The interface would probably really obtuse, but the basics haven't really changed on Civilization in what's been, 1991, 30 some odd years. It's still basically the same game. And not in a bad way, in a great way, because, you know, it's a formula that will, as you say, stand the test of time.
You mentioned Ultima Underworld there as well. And, you know, was the idea of that game, I mean, obviously it tied in the narrative aspect of it as well and was a really immersive game as well. Was that kind of one element that stood out to you playing Ultima Underworld?
Yeah, I think if Ultima Underworld was the genesis of, that sparked in me the potential of emerging gameplay. Like I remember still, and it was at the time, there was nothing like it. There was no, all the dungeon games back then were like wizardry where you'd move you weren't really moving in a 3D space. You were moving on a grid and you would move an entire grid square at a time. And nothing really happened in the physical environment. It was just a very crude mapping of basically a mini game of combat you'd get into when you got into a square with an enemy in it. And it was this turn-based thing where Ultima Underworld was so innovative. A, you know, it's the first game with really an immersive 3D rendered, fully 3D environment, because Doom is, you know, Doom and Duke Nukem were really 2.5D. You know, they weren't really 3D. You couldn't have a space over a space in those games. Where in Underworld, I remember, and you know, and the earlier Dungeon Crawl games were every encounter stood on its own. You would never like merge encounters or have any emergent stuff come out of it. So I remember I was playing Ultima Underworld, and I was like ran into some orcs or something or goblins, and I was being chased by them. And then I turn a corner while I'm chasing these orcs, and I ran into this spider, like this giant spider. And that combination of those two things, I still remember the moment of those two things combining, which was like, boo, what's this? What's this? I'm like, and I didn't know the word, but the word was emergence, right? That experience happened to me. It wasn't a designer planned that. It was, I made it happen. You could find fish and you could eat it for a certain number of hit points, but you could also put it in the fire and that would cook it. And then you get more hit points back. So all these little tiny emergent systems that, you know, obviously, you know, we're doing BioShock, making sure things could light on fire properly. And as you'd expect, you know, that the world behaves in a way that you'd expect it to. Because once that happens, you can do a lot more with the game, because you don't really have to train that putting food in fire cooks it, right?
Yeah.
You know, you allow for that and then let the player find it. And the more the world starts behaving as we expect it to, the more the player can then engage in strategizing and thinking of ways they can, you know, leverage the world. So that game was probably, that game led to my career, you know, in terms of me understanding what I wanted to do as a game designer. So that game was probably the most influential game on me in my career.
Was the pacing a huge part of it as well? Because, you know, as you said, playing like dungeon crawlers before, you'd be clicking through sections and suddenly you'd be chucked into it in Ultima Underworld, and you'd have to be really like reactionary and looking at stuff like BioShock. You know, you're chucked into a situation and you've kind of got to react with that speed.
Yeah, I think, you know, it allows for events to happen that the designers didn't intend, where the grid-based structure, basically you're just, you could choose what path you move through the dungeon, sort of, but eventually you're going to bump into the squares where the planned encounters were. And then it was really just like a die rolling game at that point. And I played infinite amounts of Proving Grounds of the Mad Overlord, you know, the first Wizardry game, infinite amounts, both on the Apple II and then later on my Mac as it came out. But it was great. It just wasn't, you know, that it didn't realize that emergent concept where I do think Underworld was probably one of the first games to do that in a way that feels akin to what I'm working on, what I spend the rest of my career doing.
Well, let's talk about your move into the industry then. So how did you find out about the job at Looking Glass?
There was a magazine called Next Gen, which I think was the American version of Edge.
Yeah.
And this was in the, you know, I had moved out to LA to be a screenwriter and sort of had a bit of a flash in the pan career in that. I got one job and then I never got another. And I spent the next few years sort of, very depressed, actually, because, you know, I thought I was going to have a creative career because I was like this little, you know, when I was a teenager, I was like entering all these writing contests and winning writing contests. And everybody's like, oh, kid, you're going to go far. And then I became a screenwriter, which is sort of seemed the natural fulfillment of my path. I didn't make it. And so I basically spent a bunch of years in the wilderness, like just doing, I was a computer consultant, I was a graphic designer, and I wasn't particularly passionate about any of it. You know, I was watching the clock like, you know, most people do in their jobs. And then I decided like, you know, I want to be creative. Maybe it's a different field I could be creative in. And I had been playing games my whole life, as I said. Like it was like the thing I immediately connected to. It wasn't like something I enjoyed. It was something I obsessed over. And then I was like, I was reading Next Gen and I liked it because it felt like inside the industry, sort of like Edge does a little bit. And I saw an ad for a job at Looking Glass as a designer. And I think I had applied to Westwood Studios before I had an interview, but I didn't get the job. And then I applied for the job at Looking Glass, which was like, oh, well, and I love that company because like they were working on Terra Nova at that point. And they had done System Shock, which was the first System Shock, which was the next step in immersion, you know, up from Ultima Underworld. I was blown away by that game. And I saw the job for a game ad for a game designer. I'm like, what's a game designer? Like, I never really connected that people like built the experience. You know, I didn't really understand how it happened.
I guess it was a relatively recent thing at that stage.
Yeah, game designers were a bit of a redheaded stepchild back then because, you know, programmers ruled the roost there. But it was rightfully so, because they were, a lot of them were game designers and programmers, right? The guys who did Underworld were basically all programmers and who were also game designed. And, you know, they brought an incredible amount of innovation and brilliance that, you know, without them, without those games, Ultima Underworld and System Shock 1, I'm not, you know, there's no Ken Levine career. You know, those really showed me the possibility. And I think that I sought out for a game designer and I applied. And I think because I'd been in Hollywood and this was a time, like Terra Nova had all these full motion video cutscenes in them with no offense to anybody working on Terra Nova. I love the game, but you know, the writing and the acting was not exactly top tier. But they saw me as a Hollywood guy and they thought maybe I knew something about how to make their, you know, narrative a little stronger in those departments. And they brought me in and I applied and it was like going to a game company. It was like, there's this great Simpsons episode where Bart goes into the Mad Magazine offices and first he's disappointed because he thinks it's just a boring office. And then like the door opens and like Alfred E. Newman and all these crazy characters are behind the door. and it's sort of like you go into the office. It was a boring office in Cambridge, Massachusetts by the train station. Very boring office park. But when you went in there, man, you just felt a certain magic happening. Mm. And, you know, I was walking around and people are playing games during the day, you know, their computers, and they're arguing about games and they're talking about games. And I was like, oh my God, like this is a job. And so I got the job somehow. And, you know, I took about a salary cut, about half what I was making as a computer consultant in New York. You know, they offered me a partnership to stay in the computer consulting firm. And I said, and these guys were really nice guys I was working for, but I said, guys, there's literally nothing you could offer me that would make me stay. I really appreciate it, but this is like a dream for me. And yeah. I went there and, I'll never forget my first, you know, year at Looking Glass. It was an incredible experience.
You started on a Star Trek Voyager game, which is interesting that you're talking about Terra Nova as well, because that time there were a lot of like sci-fi titles in the kind of video game world. That got cancelled as well. What happened with that one?
So that was like a Sierra-style adventure using the Star Trek Voyager characters.
Okay.
And so like a Sarah adventure, you like walk around and I was working on that, which is weird because I don't really like those. Like I enjoy King's Quest at the time because it was graphical and cool, but the sort of like there's one solution thing, you know, to me has never been super fun. I never really like Zerk games or anything for the same reason, which makes me weird for an old timer. Most people just Zerk's a huge touchstone for them. But for me, I really like the games that have emergence, you know, like Castle Wolfenstein, the original, you know, I don't know, does your audience know about the original Castle Wolfenstein and the Apple II before?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You know, that game was another massive inspiration. But yeah, so I was working on a game. I was splitting my time between the thing that became Thief and the Voyager game. And the half of my day I worked on Thief was by far the better half. Like I was writing for the Voyager game and like, I love the original Star Trek, it really wasn't really my thing because it was not emergent in any way, shape, or form. It wasn't really a good game for Looking Glass to be working on because I think they were trying to put emergence into it. Like I remember there was a moment where I was talking to a programmer, a friend of mine on the project. He was writing a physics system for the Voyager game. And I said, you know, why do we have a physics system in this game? It's a Sierra adventure game. There's no simulation element. And he was like, and this is one of the smartest guys I ever met. He was just assigned this, this John Che, my co-founder. Of Irrational, yes, before he became my co-founder. And he's like, yeah, I'm not really sure why there's a physics system. And I think it was just sort of the natural Looking Glass thing to do to put some element of simulation, even though the game really didn't need it or leverage it in any meaningful way. So it was sort of a doomed project. It was not at the right company. And I don't think I was the right guy necessarily to be writing it. But I wrote a bunch of stuff for it. I did my best. But compared to working on the Thief stuff and all the games before Thief became Thief, I think I was way more interested in that because that was really the Looking Glass sort of, you know, open-ended simulation emergent gameplay.
Yeah, I wondered about how like open-ended the brief was then. Was it just like create an RPG?
It was literally Paul Narath, the president, would do the team presentations and he'd plot out a timeline of future projects, and they would have very rough names, like Military Flight Sim became, you know, was an expansion on the flight game they had. And then there was RPG and action RPG. And I got assigned to the sort of action RPG with Doug Church, who was, you know, the, it was sort of the guy behind a lot of Underworld and System Shock. And, you know, and it was many different projects before it became Thief. I like, we kissed a lot of frogs. I came up with like 7 or 8 different concepts, like, you know, 5-10-page documents of concepts that Doug would read. We talk about it, then eventually he'd say, I don't know about this one. And, you know, I learned very quickly there that to not get too attached to my ideas. But I do think Thief was the best of them. And I think we it was the right thing to cancel all those ideas. And Doug taught me a lesson about throwing things away and how important that is to find something better. I mean, you could do that to an extreme, but I think that's a really valuable lesson.
How big a job was it to create the Dark Engine internally?
Yeah, so I used it extensively, but I claim zero credit for creating anything in it. That was, you know, a bunch of really smart engineers there. They built their own engine. It was a constructive solid geometry engine, subtractive rather than additive. Those words mean anything to you. You know, basically the world starts as a giant block of stone and you make air pockets in it basically to make your dungeon, to make your thief levels. And then you'd have solid brushes that you would sort of make pillars in out of that. But you were basically carving out of a giant piece of rock effectively. And it was a very interesting engine for its time because it had a lot of amazing capabilities, like the AI, how the AIs worked and how they heated up and cooled down. A lot of that came out of like the conversations that Doug and I have been having about what we wanted to see out of AI in the game. So through all the iterations of the game before it became Thief, it was like called Better Red Than Undead for a while. It was called Split Knuckle. It was called Dark Elves Must Die. Split Knuckle was like a kung fu game. There was School of Mages or School of Wizards, which was like a magic using game. And eventually, but they all had this idea that the enemies would not just see you and attack you, that they would get suspicious that there was somebody there. I mean, Jug and I was like, is there somebody there? That became the phrase we kept repeating. And that, I think, was the genesis of the sort of Thief game in the sense that it was a game about not being detected. And that's why the thief idea was the strongest, because it really leaned into that very clever AI idea we have, but more importantly, the very clever implementation of it by the team of that AI system. And then, you know, people coming up with, like, you know, the whole darkness crystal based upon the intensity of light map under your feet. You know, so it was a very innovative game, and I really enjoyed it. Was great. I enjoyed working on that game a lot. I still remember it very fond. It was the first game I ever worked on that shipped.
Well, how important was it to be ahead with an engine back then? I mean, was that a bit of an arms race?
It was, but we were pretty, I mean, it depends on what you're looking for. Like in terms of rendering speed and everything, it was pretty far behind. It was slow. One challenge it had is it created, in order to instantiate an object, it was extremely expensive, you know, at runtime to instantiate objects. I remember we were trying to make, later on when we went to do System Shock 2, and, you know, me being the game designer, I'm like, you got a pistol and you got a shotgun, you got a machine gun. The machine gun was a real problem because the game cannot create the bullets objects fast enough to make a believable machine gun, because it just, that was a real expensive proposition because it had a fairly complex object database. It had an item system that allowed things like System Shock 2 to exist at the time. You know, first person game with sort of RPG level, you know, object depth, but it also made the game very, very slow. So we, you know, when we did System Shock 2, we deliberately decided to make it a slower paced game because we knew the engine couldn't keep up with, you know, Quake and Unreal and things like that in terms of speed.
And that was kind of when you set up Irrational Games as well. And it's a really interesting name. And was the idea to kind of, you know, give you a bit more freedom and kind of, you know, be able to experiment more with ideas?
Yeah, like I've never been very good with bosses, you know? So like I was at Looking Glass for a year and a half, and I kind of was like, oh, I wish I could just run this thing because it would run better and the game would go faster and blah, 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 which is probably really naive of me, right? I was, you know, you always think you're, you know, when you get in the industry that you've got a new way of doing things. Now, of course, I think that's also a benefit because when we did System Shock 2, like only one of us had ever shipped a game with the three partners before. Like John and I hadn't. Only Rob Fermier had shipped a game. And so the value of not knowing what you're doing combined with some real dumb luck made, you know, System Shock 2 work, I think. Those guys knew way more than we were doing than I did. Like, I was really inexperienced. And that game couldn't have been made without those two guys, you know, with they're both programmers. And you know, John was an excellent product manager. But I think I was empowered by what I didn't know at the time, that, you know, you could make this big game with these, you know, horror game with, you know, this engine and, you know, all the aspects that made the game unique. I think I was just designing what I thought would be cool. And as you get to learn more, you start to dismiss certain things because you know they're hard to do or whatever, people don't like them. Then sometimes you make assumptions probably that aren't true. So it's challenging to stay innovative as your career gets longer because you sort of wear into certain patterns. Where I started, I had no patterns, you know, to obey. I was making the patterns in real time for myself.
And I guess that enabled you to take more risk as well and just go with an idea that you were really confident with.
Yeah, there were times, like I remember like one day I came to John, I was like, hey, I really think this, or I had spec'd out a level. Like I did the documents for each of the levels and what, you know, the medical level and the engineering level, blah, 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 but what, you know, the story would happen there. And there was a level I wanted on the surface of the ship that would have zero G, you know, action and or low gravity action. And John was like, dude, we have 14 months to make this game. Like, what are you even thinking? And I wasn't thinking is the thing. Like I was not thinking, I didn't understand how expensive that would be or how complicated that would be at the time and how much work. And I didn't understand the concept of doing work, a ton of work for a short period of the game, you know, one-off work was when you have limited resources was not a good idea. So there are things that definitely I stumbled into that weren't a good idea, but my partners helped me through that. And I think we ended up making, you know, we narrowed down to the things we could do. And, you know, and certainly the story elements, the engine was pretty good at, you know, at the time for supporting some of the story elements. So, you know, I built a lot of those cutscenes and they were, you know, there wasn't a great tool set, you know, to make those. So they were pretty hacked together, but, you know, we made it work.
You mentioned about the levels there and, you know, the level design and the audio in particular as well on System Shock 2 was very immersive. I mean, was that kind of bringing more atmosphere into the game, something that you really wanted to establish as kind of a something that you'll bring to your titles, as something you'll be known for?
Yeah, I remember like, so System Shock 1 came out on floppy disks originally. This is when I was, before I was in the games industry. And I played it briefly. I played the demo for the PC Gamer magazine. It used to come like a floppy disk with a demo on it. And I wasn't very impressed. And then the CD-ROM version came out that added the audio logs were just text originally. And then they added the recordings of the audio logs, which are so atmospheric. That was Eric Brosius, you know, did that, and Greg LaPiccolo at Looking Glass. And, you know, they did the sound treatment. And Eric's, you know, and Greg's sound treatment was so sophisticated and so moody that I immediately is like, recognized it as a major tool to creating tension and drama. And so, like, poor Eric was just, like, never, I would never leave him alone. I would just bother him constantly. And he would just, you know, make really impossible things happen. Like, I don't even know. If you go look at the tools that they have, how they designed the original Shodan voice, you know, it's extremely complicated. Like, all the, you know, all the breakups of voice, you know, all her weird vocal tics, all those were handmade. And, you know, I can't even imagine how rudimentary the tools were back then relative to what they have now. But I don't think anybody's really topped that audio design for Shodan, for a character voice stream.
It's really interesting, that kind of creation of that nightmarish feel in FPSs generally, like, you know, coming from Doom as well, you have that kind of nightmarish feel. And it's something that really stands out. And, you know, other games, they go for ultra realism, stuff like that. You feel like you're in like a military kind of simulation. Was that edgy feel something that you really wanted to, you know, get into?
Yeah, I think my games have always, the games I've worked on have always been a bit, I was never very interested in realism, you know. There are a lot of games that are, you know, that want to get, you know, exactly, you know, how, you know, a Colt 1911 and 45, you know, 45 caliber pistol works exactly, get the kick exactly right, and they go out to the range and they'll, you know, they'll test it and everything. And, you know, we made a game called SWAT where we tried to do that, but that was never really my thing. I tend to like more exaggerated reality. And so I think
otherworldly kind of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the great thing about audio is it can help you identify a space, especially back then when the graphics were so low resolution, like System Shock 2. I remember showing it to my parents and they didn't even really understand what it was because it was so visually rudimentary games back then that unless you grew up as a gamer back then, because, you know, you guys are, I don't know how old you are, but there, I mean, gaming wasn't back then. It's not like everybody played games. Like only the weird nerd kids played games. Like there was like four or five kids in the school who played games. I'm sure we probably all share a lot of like, you know, personality traits in terms of our ability to make friends and everything like that. It was sort of a nice, it was a oasis, you know, for weird nerdy kids because it addressed the kind of like fantasies we wanted to have, you know, where we weren't some weird nerdy, you know, eighth grader, you know, but some powerful figure or or cast into a strange world. And I think that the visuals are so rudimentary that you really had to use your imagination. But the audio, once you had like the jump from System Shock 1 to System Shock 2 in terms of having that really realistic sounding audio, or at least, you know, sorry, not authentic sounding, like realistic, you know, we weren't trying to make totally realistic spaces. Though we did, you know, endeavor to make the ship that the game took place on, the Von Braun, feel lived in a way that shooters weren't doing at that time. You know, that there were people who lived here and they, you know, the very small stories, love stories and family breakups and, you know, business stories about competition and business and ideological struggles and medical experiments going wrong, people losing their humanity. And, you know, remember, we're all in-house voice actors pretty much too. So, you know, we really didn't have, you know, I didn't have access to like these great actors that we have access to now. And there's some, you know, embarrassing voice acting, including myself on System Shock 2. But I like the combination of the, you know, craziness of what was happening in the many and showdown with the very sort of quotidian problems that people were facing on the ship, you know, their day-to-day lives, their business rivalries, their romantic problems, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's talk about BioShock. That game, you know, when we got to the mid-2000s, such a massive game. And I remember, you know, one of the first real games that I got into on the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3 when those consoles came around. Spent hours on that game. So let's talk about when you first thought about BioShock and the idea. And how was it first proposed? And kind of talk us through the initial stages of BioShock.
It really came, I think, from a desire of people on the team who joined Irrational, either who worked on System Shock 2 or came afterwards, that they came to work on games like that. And we weren't making games like that at that time because System Shock 2 didn't make any money, right? And I was the guy who had to like make the payroll work, you know? And so I was pretty hesitant to, well, A, you know, you go out and pitch these things and usually you have to make some kind of rough prototype. So you're committing a reasonable amount of resources. At the time we had like zero money to doing this. And you have to then finish it up with, oh, and it's, by the way, it's sort of a spiritual successor to this game that didn't really sell. And there are a lot of journalists and a lot of executives, junior executives of the company at the publishing companies who love System Shock 2. And there's a million guys who went into their office trying to sell BioShock. I was nervous about it selling. And so I was nervous about making it. But finally, the team convinced me to basically fund an internal prototype. And we made it. And I took it out, tried to sell it, and it didn't go anywhere. And so I was ready to sort of throw in the towel on it. And I think it was a bummer for everybody because I think that's why they came to the company. But we, you know, we're working on like Tribes Vengeance and we're working on SWAT 4, which are fine games, but they weren't what people came to the company necessarily to make. And I was so desperate just to keep the business going because it was a day-to-day struggle to keep the business going. Like I do not miss that part of my job where I had to raise money. Now for sure I work, you know, since I sold the company, I don't have to do that anymore. But that was like massively high stress. So, but I wanted to make that type of game. The team really wanted to make it. I was just tempered by my worries about the business side. But I had this idea, kind of weird idea where I'm like, okay, there's this great book, which I still draw insight from, called Adventures in the Screen Trade, that a screenwriter who wrote like All the President's Men, this is from the 70s, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. A lot of your audience may not even know those movies, but he was a well-known screenwriter named William Goldman. And he, they might know Misery. I think he wrote this screenplay to Misery. And he had these two rules about Hollywood. And the two rules were, nobody knows anything, which means none of the executives trust their own opinions. They're always looking to other people to validate that, because that's why you see so many copycat stuff like, oh, we're going to have our own superhero universe, right? Everybody's, we're going to have our own universe. And it, you know, everybody tries to do their own MCU and they all fail because it's a tricky formula to get right. So that was one rule. But the other rule is, nobody knows anything. And that was the main rule that I reacted to. I was like, okay, well, what if I can make art of, how can I make people seem excited about this? And that would help the executives convince themselves and their bosses that there's something there, because they're seeing excitement, not just in them and somebody outside. So I knew a journalist named Andrew Park at GameSpot. And I called him up and I said, Andrew, look, why don't you come out to the office and you can do a, I think he had mentioned once to me about doing a System Shock retrospective, but you could also do an article on this new game we're working on called Bioshock. And I didn't have a publisher at this point. And he came out and we did that article. And like the next day, the phone started ringing off the hook, because this was the nobody knows anything thing, where all of a sudden everybody was getting interested in it because they read the article. And it was sort of by convincing GameSpot, which is, one of the biggest, two biggest sites at that point, to cover it, that gave it a stamp of approval. And very shortly afterwards, we were able to set up a deal for it.
It must have been quite a hard thing, you know, trying to get the press involved in a game with like an Art Deco style and a background based on literature and, in a world with FPSs where they weren't that, that intelligent.
I would say that actually, no, the journalists were very, originally didn't have we didn't even have the Art Deco style. We didn't have Rapture. It was a very rude, it was a whiff of an idea of a game. Okay. And when we took it out originally, it had like this, it was about this World War II underwater base off this island of Nazis were still, it was as a placeholder because I didn't have that much, I was, trying to run the business. We were working on three games at once and I didn't have that much time to work on this thing. So we sort of said it's, basically going to be a System Shock 2 spiritual successor. And the details really changed. But I think once the press saw it, I think they got quite excited because I think it allowed them, I never had the problem with, I think there are some people, especially at that time, who kind of, especially like people who went to journalism school, who might be a little embarrassed, been a little embarrassed to be game journalists, because it's not like you're the Washington bureau chief, or you're covering movies or something like that. You're meeting Tom Cruise. It was a pretty rinky-dink industry at that point, but the weird nerds mostly. It wasn't nearly mainstream at all like it is now. And I think that the fact that Bioshock had some themes that were a little more, for lack of a better word, a little more sort of elevated or informed by different references, like more by literature or, politics or whatever. I think they saw that as great, because then they can say to the people around them who they might have been embarrassed, to say they're working on games, oh, but see, games now can do this. And frankly, I never cared. Like, there's a lot of people who feel like we need to show people that games can be X, Y, or Z. And I never cared that games were goofy, like that I'm a duck, or a frog jumping across a road onto logs, or I'm Qbert or whatever. I just had fun with them. I was never embarrassed by them or thought they were anything but valid. Valid by who? I just needed to be valid by me. But I think a lot of people struggled at the time because the games didn't have a lot of social cachet. And I think Bioshock was, I can't read minds, but I have a feeling a lot of the reasons they were attracted to it, because it elevated, elevated the themes a little bit over, say, like Duke Nukem or Doom. But I never mind Duke Nukem or Doom. Like, I didn't need the elevation. I was mostly writing from a place of the I had weird eclectic tastes, but you know, I wanted to do was little different things, but it never stopped me from playing any game. I don't think any games are dumb or, you know, because they're not quote sophisticated.
Yeah. There's some awesome, slugfests and kind of, you know, titles. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there's no shame in that.
Well, I guess, you know, the advances in technology must have helped as well. You know, you go from System Shock 2 in 1999, you know, just half a decade later with BioShock, you know, stuff like water effects was something that, you know, in the late 90s, it felt like the technology struggled a bit with, but that kind of came into its own around that time. And do you think that helped with the atmosphere and the immersion, maybe stuff that wouldn't have been possible, you know, 5 years earlier?
BioShock was the game where my parents could look at it and say, oh, we understand what we're seeing here. It's not a bunch of abstract shapes. I see it's a Art Deco, you know, restaurant. And that was huge. You know, I think that the Xbox 360, et cetera, that generation could render believable looking spaces that with just a little bit of imagination, you could push over the edge to really get immersed in. If you weren't like a weird nerd like me who could get immersed in the Ultima Underworld graphics. Now you go back to my Ultima Underworld now and it's very crude looking, right? It's kind of hard to get immersed in now, but I could, but now pretty much anybody can be immersed by the stuff we're doing because it's, you know, the rendering technology is such that it's pretty sophisticated.
And did, you know, the first time you saw Big Daddy, how did that kind of happen? And was it great to have kind of such an iconic image for the series?
Yeah, you know, the game design really started with the concept of the Big Daddy and Little Sister as a design concept. But I think it was Nate Wells who did the first Big Daddy sketch, the guy in the diving suit. And it evolved a bunch from them, but sort of the humped shape of him, you know, where he doesn't really have a head. He's got it, like his face is in his belly, you know, or his chest. Nate caught something. Nate was also very good at, he had a really keen eye for industrial design, which I think a lot of people in the games industry struggle with. And that's why you see a lot of technology. Sometimes it doesn't look very believable. Nate had a really keen eye for industrial design. So the character looked very believable, even though he's fantastical. And the little sister, the concept was there, but the design for the little sister came much later, sometime later from an artist named Rob Waters. We went through a lot of concepts. Like it was like a bug for a while. It was like a monkey for a while. It was all these different things that weren't right until we got the little girl concept. But I think the little sister, as soon as I saw that picture of the Big Daddy, like I knew what I wanted conceptually. And I think Nate was the guy who thought of the diving suit. And once I saw that drawing, you know, it's probably differs somewhat substantially from the final thing, but the basic silhouette was there, and that is, you know, incredibly important. And the vibe was there.
One aspect of BioShock that really made it stand out was, you know, turning the player into a weapon with genetic modification. Where did that idea come from?
You know, and we had this concept in this hybrid concept in System Shock 2 that you'd have like these sort of psionic powers, you know. We didn't have left-hand powers back then. It was basically like another weapon you equipped it. So you had sort of magic spells, essentially, because we were making an RPG, but we wouldn't have magic spells. So we had these psionic powers. In BioShock, we wanted something similar. I don't remember what the chicken or the egg was, but we knew we wanted it to be central to the storyline of the game, you know? And so, you know, I was thinking about the Randian stuff, about how there should be no limitations on the human endeavor, no regulation. And I thought, well, what if you had this technology and there was no regulatory body, you know? This incredibly powerful technology, and what might it do to people, and why it become the dominant, you know, economic driver of a city. And so I think, I don't remember exactly where the idea, we knew we needed magic spells basically, but we didn't really have I can't remember if we thought of this being a critical part of the story first, or we just thought, okay, well, it's probably genetics. How about that? And, you know, we did a little bit of research on that stuff, and, you know, actually, that guy Nate Wells helped again. He's the one who came up with the term plasmids, because he didn't, unlike me, he didn't fail biology. I think he was pre-med at one point. And so, you know, we were off to the races.
Well, BioShock Infinite as well was just absolutely amazing. But that was another huge gap between the games and a growth in technology as well. You know, developing Columbia, did that really help that kind of change in technology? And I know... some of the consoles kind of struggled with it a bit because it was so advanced. But, you know, the PC version really kind of worked well.
Yeah, that was you know, another generation. And, you know, we had this idea for, you know, the opposite of a city, you know, a city that looks very different than Rapture. And, you know, rendering it to seem like it was floating in the air presented a bunch of challenges, because I didn't want the just things being static in the air, because then it would look like what it was, which is a bunch of platforms hanging in the air. And that was a kind of technological trick that the team built. Like, it was a very clever piece of trickery, essentially. Like, nothing was really floating. I don't know if the guys ever talked about the methodology. If they haven't, they should do a talk on it. It was very interesting and hard to do. And we wanted big, open, airy spaces, which is the opposite. But, you know, the other big technological challenge in that game was Elizabeth, you know, this companion character. And that's, at that point, I was really attracted to, characters, you know. My favorite part of Bioshock was making, you know, Andrew Ryan and Steinman and Cohen. That's something we didn't really, and well, we had Shodan at System Shock 2, but she, you know, so I inherited that character, very fortunate to inherit that character. I really loved writing that relationship, that sort of frenemy relationship between you and Shodan. And, you know, then I got more interesting relationships in Bioshock. And then I was like, okay, well, let's really do a relationship. And that's where Elizabeth came from, and really center her as the main feature of the game. And that was really cool. You know, the only downside was you got to know her really well, but you couldn't really make any impact on her. You know, she didn't really get to know you in a meaningful way. And I think that's what led to, you know, our thinking in Judas, is we really want to have characters who understood you as well as you understand them, or at least, you know, more than we've seen in our previous products.
Well, we'll definitely get onto the new game Judas in just a moment. Before that, though, I mean, I was reading recently that Bioshock is set to become a Netflix series production. They're going to be turning that into a movie or TV series, I saw. Have you had much involvement in that then, or any involvement at all? And are you looking forward to watching it?
I met with the guys like once, and I just don't, like, I can't really work on something casually, you know? So I don't really have time to make a movie, because I'm making games, you know, and I actually really like making games. And so I don't really know what's going on with it, you know, so, and I try not to be a little involved with things, because I don't think that's where I'm any good. I'm not a guy who oversees like 50 projects, you know, I'm a guy who gets really deep into a project. And so I'm not really.
Well, a project you've got really deep with is Judas, which we've been seeing footage of all online. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a couple of trailers for it, and we just did our first big press event for it. So the coverage came out last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago. And you can read a lot about there. We did something with IGN and something with a YouTuber called SkillUp, and they have a podcast called Friends Per Second. And also Jeff Keighley came out to see it. And we were really, you know, I don't have that much time. You know, I'd probably get a much better description in that interview. But it's basically character, character, character. How do we put the player in another one of our worlds, you know, a fully, you know, if people find our worlds to be sort of more fully realized, I think they'll see, you know, the sort of the next, you know, the next fully realized world from us, which is a spaceship called the Mayflower Colony Ship, orbiting Proxima Centauri after they left Earth because fears of a plague that would wipe out all of humanity. Of course, COVID hadn't happened when we came up with that plot, but life has a way of catching up with you. But the core there is really having the game pay attention to everything you do on a fairly granular level, and having characters who can have that knowledge of you and interact with you, calling out things you've done very specifically, and having evolving, challenging relationships with these very complicated, messy characters that were a two-way street, not just a one-way street. Because Elizabeth is essentially a one-way street. Like, she would just follow you along. I had this one notion, and I talk about this in the interview, but there was one point late in the development on Bioshock where it's like, God, it'd be really cool if Booker could just become so violent and so awful that Elizabeth just says, well, screw you, Booker, I'm out. But there was no methodology to do that at all in the game. Like, there was no version of the game that didn't have Elizabeth at the end. So we really want to start from the ground up and make a game where character could get disgusted with you. You know, a character could bail on you. But to do it in kind of way that nobody had done before. We have limited time, so I can't get into all the details. But if they want to hear my talk on it, you know, you can just do a search, you know, go to IGN and see the interview I did there or for, and they have the two trailers out. And that'll give you a pretty good sense, way better than I can describe here. But again, I think we're building upon our world building and really pushing on our character interaction. Because I love characters. I love creating interesting characters, challenging characters. And so most of our energy has been, how do we make those characters leap off the page at you and let you interact with them in ways you know, they've never been able to in our games before.
Yeah, and I'll obviously link the trailer in the show notes. You know, anyone that loved BioShock, I think, will be in love with this game by the looks of it already.
We definitely, the first audience we always want to please is our existing audience.
Yeah.
You know, because we're very loyal to them and they've been loyal to us, and we want to make sure we're making a game that takes the things they love and goes further than what we've done before. Each game has sort of been an evolution, a big evolutionary step. This one's reasonably big step because taking a long time. That's one of the reasons it takes a long time. It's a bigger step than what we've made before.
Any idea when it's going to be released? Is it, do you think it'll be this year?
We have not talked about that yet.
Right, fair enough.
But people were able to come to the studio and play 5-6 hours of it, you know, and all have pretty different experiences from each other. There's a lot of content in the game now. But lots of content, lots of balance, polish, all that kind of stuff to go.
Fantastic. Well, can't wait to play it, Ken. Best of luck with it. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories with us as well. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, fellas.